living it up in the city. Got Chucks on with Saint Laurent. Gotta kiss myself, I'm so pretty. I'm too hot. Call the police and the fireman. I'm too hot. Make a dragon wanna retire, man. I'm too hot. Say my name, you know who I am. I'm too hot. And my band bought that money. Break it down. Girls hit you, hallelujah. Girls hit you, hallelujah. Girls hit you, hallelujah. Cause Uptown Funk don't give it to you.
Cause Uptown Funk don't give it to you.
Cause Uptown Funk don't give it to you. Saturday night and we in the spot. Don't believe me, just watch.
Good afternoon, everyone. It's 12:09. This is Molly. You're listening to Chatting with Molly on 91.5 FM WMFO Medford, Tufts Freeform Radio. Welcome back, all my listeners. We have an exciting show today. We have a special guest on with us. Guest, would you like to introduce yourself?
Hi there, I'm Tony.
And Tony, where are you from? And what's your deal in few words?
From Seattle, Washington. My deal is still trying to be figured out.
Okay.
I'm happy to be here.
Great. Tony is a friend of mine, and I think you've actually been on the show by call-in before.
I have.
Which is pretty exciting. So today, the show is going to be slightly different because every week I have a certain caller who is my number one fan call in, aka my father, calls in every week. And this is the first week he will not be calling in because he is going to see an opera during this time, which is a classic Richard Lipman move. But we start off the show every week by asking our guest what you had for breakfast. So what did you have for breakfast?
I had eggs, spinach, potatoes, ketchup, and Texas Pete sauce.
Wow, that is an involved breakfast. Is this a normal thing?
Yes, I try to start the meal with some greens and protein. Didn't have any meat this morning. Maybe we'll change that up tomorrow.
Nice. Wow, so is this something you like cook in the morning when you wake up, or you have things like prep before and you just like make the eggs or something?
This is DeWick's Fine Dining.
Oh, got it. Okay. That's exciting. I always loved DeWick breakfast. Some people don't show up, but I think it's a worthwhile thing.
I think this is going to be my last year of it, but it's been good to me so far.
Yeah. All right. So, Tony and I are friends on many fronts, and today I'm excited to hear about a little event, and I would actually love to hear, like, I don't know exactly your involvement. Like, are you head point on planning, or are you just like excited and doing publicity? But tell us about this event and like why it's cool.
Yeah, so first of all, I'm a tutor with the PD Green program, and this is a nonprofit in the Northeast that sends college-age students into correctional facilities to provide tutoring and education support for students on the inside.
Cool.
So I started doing that my freshman spring. So this is now my third semester being a tutor. And then This is the first year I've been on the executive board of the Tufts chapter of the PD Green program.
Cool. So do you work with the same inmates like semester to semester, or are you like doing a similar topic semesters? Like, how does that work?
Yeah, so first of all, something I learned once I started tutoring is that the language we use to describe the students is important. And
Yes. The
term that I learned is people who are incarcerated or students on the inside.
Got it.
To refer to people on the inside.
Cool.
So each year at the facility I tutor, there's a new cohort of people
Okay. Who
come in for a year-long program of job training and education.
Okay.
This is called the Boston Pre-Release Center, and it's one of the few in the state that is very radical in the kinds of things they do in their facility. For example, there's no border, so people can come and go from the facility as much as they want. They just have to be in place for the daily counts that happen.
Okay. And this is a center... wait, will you talk a little bit more about, like, what path would get you to this facility, or like if everyone is eligible to be in this type of facility or not?
Yeah, so this is called a pre-release center because it's typically people who have 1 or 2 years left on their sentence. And even if you're in that category, to be accepted into this facility, which has, I believe, in about 200 people, is very difficult and rare because the amount of freedom you're given at this place.
Right. And sorry, you may have already said this. Is this state level or federal?
This is state. This is Massachusetts Department of Corrections.
Got it. Interesting. So would this facility be like a similar option to granting someone parole early off of like good behavior? Do you know what? Like some sentences are that like, with 5 years left in your sentence, you can be like re-judged on your like behavior and the progress you've made and be let off on parole. Is this something that could go like in tangent with something like that?
I don't know for sure, but okay. I believe so. Cool. As you approach the end of your sentence, you have some more options in terms of where you can be and what you can do. That being said, there's also people at this facility who have been sent back to higher security for infraction. So it's not a permanent location.
Got it. And so the students you're working with, are you working with the same student semester to semester?
So as I mentioned, each cohort comes in for a year. So
right.
The last two semesters have been with one person. Then this spring is a new cohort. So now I have a new student.
So it's like January to January.
Yeah, roughly.
Okay, cool. Wow, that sounds awesome. Do you feel like it's a program that's making a difference?
That's something I think a lot about. I think there's a lot of programs out there that have a flashy name or title associated with the kinds of service they're doing.
Mm-hmm.
And in contrast, the PD Green program is pretty low-key in the sense that all I do each week is go tutor someone for an hour.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not a systemic type of work. It's very one-on-one, direct.
Yeah.
But I do think that the impact is very big on that one person.
Yeah.
And that means providing not only education, but a human connection with someone on the outside who's going to say, hey, I care about you and I'm going to show up every week. And that's taught me a lot as well, in addition to the student.
Cool. And what do you tutor?
So there's the GED equivalent called the HiSET, which is the test that most people in there are studying.
Mm-hmm.
We tutor various modules and pieces from that test.
Like math, reading.
Yeah.
Like scientific method.
Yeah.
Cool. Wow. That's very exciting. So will you tell us a little bit what's happening tonight at 7?
Yes. So we have a couple follow-up trainings each year for PD Green tutors in the surrounding community. And the idea behind these trainings is to say, we're glad that you're going in and tutoring, and that's important work, but it's also important to learn about the systems and the actions behind what has created the facility you go and interact with every day. So one of these trainings is tonight, and what we've done is brought in the district attorney of Suffolk County, Rachel Rollins, to speak about her work as a progressive-minded prosecutor in this system.
Cool. So does PD Green work with the like other links in the Justice Department, like whoever this attorney works for?
So PD Green has most of its contact, the nonprofit does, with the Department of Corrections.
Okay.
And each facility has a different bureaucracy, and yes. it's very difficult to get approved to send tutors in, because right. that means you've first had to have approved an educational program,
right,
etc.
Wow, very interesting. So I'm curious to hear, like you said, you've learned a lot. I'd love to hear kind of like, I'm sure this is a huge thing that could take up many hours, but kind of like recapping, either if there's anecdotes that like stick out in your mind, or yeah, just like cool conversations you've had with the students on the other side, on the inside.
Yeah, so confidentiality is very important, and so I'll do my best to speak in the most general terms.
Yes, general is totally fine.
But I think there's two moments that stand out. One was from my time last year, and the student I was working with was an older person who was, he sort of knew that he wasn't going to be looking for a shiny new job on the outside.
Yeah.
But what he said to me was, I want to learn this stuff for my grandkids, because I know that I didn't have someone to teach me and be there for me when I was growing up and going to school.
Wow.
And then, and that stuck with me because it's easy if you read mainstream media to forget the humanity that these
behind
people
the
have
statistics
on the
that
inside.
We hear. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's true that the people in there have committed what we deem crimes.
Mm-hmm.
And it's also true that talking to someone else, saying, I dropped out of high school and I didn't know how to read. My only options for putting food on the table were stealing and selling drugs. And I think that really put it in perspective for me. It's not always okay to say this is a bad person who's done a bad thing. It's important to look at the choices they had at the time.
Right. I actually think about this a lot in terms of morality, because I really like to define my own life in like very clear terms, like black and white, and not defining it for others, but like giving myself a guideline of black and white. And I think the more I think about morality, it has nothing to do with like universal truths. It really has to do with like the setting in which you're presented options, like you said. And like, to me, morally, I have a big problem with myself stealing. Like, if I were to steal something, I would like think of that as a moral injustice. But that's only because I have not been put in the situation in which I've had to like choose between this moral high ground I've created for myself or like actually like feeding myself and my family. And I think that like the notion that like stealing is wrong kind of eliminates the nuance of like people's situation.
Yeah.
And I think that's something, and that can be applied to like every moral question. And I think the law like really addresses that in like murder. You know, we have self-defense as like, that is a situation in which the law makes an exception for a certain scenario. And I think like the law could do more about like looking at circumstances. I mean, I don't know what that looks like. I'm not a justice reform expert, but yeah, I think that's really interesting. And what would you say, so in this, for the students on the inside, what's the gender breakdown? Is it just a single gender facility, or is it like male and female?
So I'll respond to that. I also wanted to say one thing
yeah.
about what you
yeah,
just said,
do.
Which think it is very important to recognize that morality can have different forms, and there's circumstances that call for self-defense, etc. That being said, I think it's important to recognize in the U.S. how that term specifically has been made it much more difficult for justice for Black folks.
Yeah.
One example in particular I'm thinking of is a young Black man named Jordan Davis who was playing music at a gas station in Florida, and a white man who was also getting gas felt threatened and saw what he might have considered a weapon and shot the car, killing Jordan Davis.
Right.
And the initially under Florida's Stand Your Ground law, which you may or may not have heard of, the man who shot Jordan Davis was acquitted. And so even saying, okay, it's okay to have self-defense has meant different things for different communities in the United States.
I totally agree that there's like systematic injustice for Black people. And people all people of color and all marginalized people do not get treated equally in court. But that doesn't mean that what's your commentary on self-defense? Do you think it doesn't have a place? Because I think it does a lot more good. Like, I think that example is more pointing out a problem in other things in our justice system than a self-defense law. Because self-defense is used a lot in a very good way to make people okay with quite literally defending themselves against an attacker, you know, and that can help marginalized people also. I don't know if you think these are pretty really difficult questions, judging does harm outweigh the good? But I think, I don't know, do you have a big picture statement on the self-defense law?
Yeah, well, first of all, this is opinions that I have and coming from communities that are not facing systemic racism and police violence. I can't speak for those people, but my understanding from some of the news sources I follow that report on the criminal justice system is, although self-defense is important and necessary and does have many good applications, there's been moments when police officers or oppressors have used "I was defending myself" to enact more violence,
right,
against Black and brown bodies. So what I would say is that there must be a critical lens of self-defense in addition to having it exist.
Okay.
Not just accepting self-defense is everything, is the answer to.
Okay, but when you make so let's say we make a pretty critical line. We make a threshold that you have to prove some type of harm that you were put in. But that means someone who's in a position that's not a police that would be using it for good and doesn't have any type of body camera, doesn't have any type of footage but maybe they were in a lesser position of power as opposed to this situation, and they defended themselves and have no way to prove it, and then go to jail for defending an attacker on themselves. And I think I would love to look into the statistics of how in what ways self-defense is actually brought up in court. But I think that we don't read on the news girl was attacked in alley, defended herself and killed her attacker, and all was good. You know, like, I mean, that's not a happy story, but I think we read in the news the times in which things go wrong. And we don't hear about, like, the hundreds of thousands of cases in which it goes right. But I, like, I am not disagreeing with you that this is, like, a tool in which people, white people in power, use against black and brown people. And I think that you're right. Maybe there are, like, thresholds we should tack on, but it's also going to, like, tack that on to everyone else using it also. And that's what makes prison reform so difficult, because you're making laws for situations that you don't know how they're going to apply yet.
Yeah.
I don't know.
That's why I'm very interested to hear what the district attorney has to say tonight. And obviously, her wealth of knowledge will be much more than what we can come up with. There's a couple cool things that have been going on about her candidacy and her tenure as a district attorney.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, in August, during the primary for the election seat, she put out a list of 15 crimes and low-level misdemeanors that she said, "I will not seek jail time for these if I'm elected."
Wow.
Because they disproportionately harm poor people and black and brown people. And she got a lot of flack from police officers and from critics saying she was, quote, soft on crime.
Yeah.
And she still was elected, won the primary, and then won 80% of the vote, something like that.
Amazing.
And then now she's in office. The question is, okay, you said this.
Yeah.
What is it? What has it been like to implement these policies, which are that kind of reform has not really been done in many cities in the United States. And so right now, like in the last week, she's been criticized both by the ACLU for saying, hey, you're not doing a good enough job of not prosecuting these things you said you wouldn't prosecute.
Yeah.
And she's also getting criticized from police unions and from ICE, saying
she needs to do more.
You're making us feel unsafe because you don't, your policies don't support our jobs.
Right.
And I think that's a fascinating conflict of how the, an example of how the institutions that are she's trying to reform have a lot of power and sway in actually making those reforms happen even after she's elected.
Yeah. And I think, like, if you're getting hit from both sides, that means you're probably doing a pretty good job of being right in the middle. And I mean, like, I don't know if that's a good job objectively, but yeah, I don't know. I think, like we've talked about, there's so much balance in everything. And I think, like, yeah, I'm so excited to hear about how, I hope she shares, like, the details of that question. And yeah. So moving on from here. So do you mind if I change the subject?
Go for it.
Okay, cool. Something I'm excited about this week is that a good friend of you and I, Benji, and I are hosting a dinner this Friday. And will you be in attendance? Not to put you on the spot on air or anything. You can say no.
Yes.
Oh, wonderful.
Maybe.
Okay. And yeah, this is something I have, like, been wanting to do for so long. It's, like, I think one of my favorite things is sharing food with people and hosting things. Hosting can be stressful, but also pretty fun. And yeah, I just wanted to share that that's something I'm excited about this week. Do you have any exciting things about your week?
Something I'm excited for this weekend is I'm going to a hackathon.
Nice.
For, quote, civic technology.
Okay. Who's hosting it?
I'm not actually sure.
Okay.
The details. I thought it sounded cool, so I signed up.
Where's the location?
Somewhere in Boston.
Okay. Nice. Do you know if you get like put on a team, or you like really don't know any details?
I believe you get put on a team.
Okay.
And I know there's a couple students from Tufts who are going, and so we'll probably transport together.
Nice.
But it's something I'm interested in doing at the cost of a lot of time I could spend doing homework, etc.
Yeah, such is life. But speaking of coding and hacking, you're still a part of Jumbo Hack? I forget what it's called. Jumbo Code.
That's an interesting
Touch
question.
Am I saying the name right? What's
it's
the name?
It's Jumbo Code.
Okay, cool. Keep going.
So I considered it and decided I couldn't make a time commitment to Jumbo Code, but as I've spent the year in the Tufts computer science department and had the opportunity to meet a lot of people and learn about the really intense pressures we are put under to pass classes and to get internships
and have side projects
and have side projects, etc. Along with one of my friends who I had was partnered with in Comp 40, we've been discussing another kind of coding club.
Okay.
That is intentionally targeted at people who are new to coding, who are still looking for a community and for projects to do. And the idea would be to have not only projects and technical support, but also talking about self-care and what is the lack of diversity in the tech sector and how that affects the decisions that are made and who gets hired, and have more of a holistic computing experience that still provides some career support.
Cool. That sounds awesome. I'm all like, yeah, that sounds really like a great idea. I'm almost more surprised that there like isn't something like that exists already. And wow, nice. So you are a comp sci major. And do you like it?
That's a big question.
I know. We get down and dirty on Chatting with Molly, the real stuff.
I think computer science is a fundamental part of our world now. And I think it's necessary to understand at some level how that works. For that reason, I'm glad that I have spent some of my time at Tufts learning how to do that. And I like the way of thinking that says we have a problem and we're going to try to solve it in a way that I solve the problem once and then we have a solution already there and we can use it to solve many more problems in the future.
Yeah.
I like that efficiency.
Yeah, modularity, right?
Modularity.
Modularity, yeah. There it is.
Yeah.
Nice.
But
and sorry, keep going.
Yeah, there's a but.
Yes,
which
but.
Is the barriers to going from I like solving problems and for me I like supporting people who are doing impactful work, the barriers from saying I want to do that to actually getting there in the path of computer science has been really difficult for me. Taking classes that are really hard and time consuming and don't feel like I'm learning things that I can apply has definitely affected my happiness at times. And this semester I'm taking a humanities class for the first time in a year. And I didn't realize how much I missed having a writing class and just a small group instead of a huge class,
right,
where we can discuss things and
yeah,
it's not all about valuing people by the code they put out there.
Yeah. And they recently came out with the, like, data science major, and I know you originally, like, a long time ago expressed that that would be something you were really interested in. Have you, like, looked into either, I don't know if it's too late to switch, or, like, taking some of those classes?
Yeah, I'm particularly interested in data science in the computer science world because I think that learning the skills of analyzing and gathering data can be applied to any realm of work.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something I hope to do maybe in politics. And those are the classes I'm starting to take now.
Cool.
Even though I don't think it's officially Tufts data science because I'm not an engineer.
Got it. Interesting. Yeah, I think... Yeah, I mean, I've had very similar feelings about taking classes I feel are not super applicable. And yeah, I think, like, higher education's really tough because it's super formal and there are a lot of, like, forces that I felt are trying to, like, path people very strictly. And, like, if you're doing CompSci, you have to take these hard classes and it's, like, gonna limit your ability to do other things. And that's really too bad. And I hope, and I think, like, Tufts is, I believe, kind of better than other institutions that, like, make you do, I think Tufts does value breadth, but I wouldn't say every major, like, allows you to experience those values. Cool. Well, I'm gonna play some music. Do you have any requests? If not, I can just hit it some classics.
That's why you're in charge of the station.
Okay, let's hit some classics. We'll do, up next is a little Top Loader with Dancing in the Moonlight.
Everybody's dancing in the moonlight.
All right, listeners, we are back. That was a little You Can't Hurry Love by Phil Collins. And now I am back in the studio. Tony had to go, and big shout to him, and thanks for coming on. And ladies and gentlemen, now we are back to our origins. Just me and the WMFO studio. Me ranting, yelling into the wind how this show began. Oh, how it feels to be back. So, I would like to just kind of recap some things Tony and I talked about. We talked about a little prison reform, which is very important. And to be quite honest, I was playing a little like devil's advocate with him in the beginning, because I think, to me, policies are really complicated. And I think that it's so important to have a super aggressive lens on trying to make things happen, but also should be very critical to see how these are going to affect, because like progressives are often criticized for being very idealistic. And honestly, to prove to people that we are not idealistic and that we are very realistic and we just believe in like a better way of doing things, I think you do have to like ask those really hard-hitting questions that are going to get asked eventually either by yourself or by your opposition. And so I try to do that with my own thinking, and I think that justice, like prison reform and justice equity, is so hard and it's so institutionalized and there's so many problems. And I wanted to bring this up to Tony, but I forgot. But for those listeners out there that find this stuff interesting, there's a podcast called Serial. It made its claim to fame for being like an investigative journalist in one story about Adnan, and that became pretty famous. Then Sarah Koenig did second season about, I don't even remember his name, but it was trash. It was straight garbage. I listened to it when I was like, had literally nothing else to do while I was making cookies in a cookie factory, and I had to switch it because I was so bored. But then came season 3, and season 3 is amazing. It is set in Cleveland, Ohio, and it is set in one corrections department, or one DA's office. Like it's literally like about this one building who kind of processes a bunch of like criminal cases. And Sarah Koenig goes through some highlighted cases, but also just talks about the system in general, and it is so interesting. And she does such a good job of like telling people's stories, I would say. So if anyone out there is interested, that's something that I think is a cool thing. And then also I was talking to Tony about something I did in Israel, which was worked for a soup kitchen. And this soup kitchen was run by a like religious organization, a bunch of rabbis, and it was a free lunch program, and it ran 5 days a week, Sunday through Thursday. And we asked no questions, and anyone can walk in and get a nice hot bowl of soup, some rice, and some like potatoes, and then some meat for the day, and then we had like some salad and some hummus in very Israeli fashion. So what I loved about this organization is that not only was it providing great meals, which I ate occasionally and were pretty good, but also they, to like staff this program, because it's a nonprofit, they were able to get previously incarcerated people who had since been on good behavior and would, I guess in the US, we would like see kind of the equivalents of like parole and mandated community service. I think this would be this was like at the end of their sentence, instead of a few years, they would be able to just like do work with this organization. And it was awesome because it was very hard work. Honestly, I was like moving sacks of potatoes, cutting beets for like 10 hours a week. And it would just be like a lot of manual labor. So it's hard work. And you like, I think being able to put in this work for other people gives you like a sense of purpose a little bit. And then also, I think the biggest thing is that you get these skills to be able to cook a meal for like 100 people. A chef is like a great entryway back into a community because you're working with food, which is such an important system that we all partake in every 3 times a day, sometimes more, depending on your snacking habits. And I think it's like such a hard skill, like a, not a difficult skill, like a durable skill that these people can come out with and then market themselves and kind of like grow, like just kind of foster their own potential of being re-involved in the community. And I think people say like that's the most important thing to keep people from re-entering the prison system, is just like getting people involved with the community and seeing like the support that you can give to others and you can receive from others. And I've always dreamed of like incorporating my interest in from food systems and prison reform, of like making this community center that like provides meals, and the people who are making these meals can be people who have like are like previously incarcerated or have had like some run-in with the Justice Department. I should look in appropriate vocabulary to use when talking about this. And having them going through like a training program of like chef skills and then coming out with some type of certificate, and hopefully this organization can have like good connections with different you know, kitchens around the community. And I think that would be so cool. And we could have like a little community garden, and kids could come like work on this garden, because kids working in gardens is so important to understand food systems. And I think there are so many aspects of like providing food for other people that can link our community together. And I think that's pretty exciting. And I'm sure that like anyone's passions can be fit into a delivery method of giving food to people, because it's just something we all do a lot of the day, and it's beautiful. And with that, we are really getting close to the wire. I gotta read a PSA. So let's see. I was joking with my brother Josh about these PSAs, and I told him there's like a one about safety ladders. Let's see if I can find it. There's so many about drinking. I don't know what that says about the Boston community, but I mean, it's an important thing to have a service announcement about. Let's see. Do. Alternative scouting. Nah, we're not interested in that. Good exercise. Ooh, go green with rechargeable batteries. Oh, guys, just wait till I rant about my robots project. We haven't even gotten to that section yet. Okay. Go green with rechargeable batteries. If you want to save yourself money and help the environment at the same time, consider using rechargeable batteries in your frequently used devices that accept them. Today's nickel MH batteries... nickel methyl hydroxide. I don't know what nickel MH is, but nickel MH batteries last about as long as alkaline cells under high use, and they can be recharged hundreds of times before needing to be recycled. Packs of rechargeable AA and AAA batteries plus a charger don't cost very much to begin with anymore, and isn't it more convenient to recharge your batteries than to go to the store and buy new ones anyway? A message from all your green friends here at WMFO in Medford, Tufts Education Radio. Well, thank you, Tufts Education Radio. That is some important stuff. Man, I have like 2.5 minutes, so let's do a little robot rant. Okay, first, to be honest, batteries are not that simple in terms of like what's sustainable and what's not. Yes, rebuying batteries is not as good as reusing, but the real problem is, what are we using to recharge these batteries? If we're using electricity that comes from burning coal, then that should be the primary focus of sustainability. But you know what? I think these people are just trying to do what they can, and it's true that, you know, doing rechargeable batteries is probably a little bit better. And honestly, hundreds of times as a lifespan is not very good. Those batteries can actually last about like 1,000 to 5,000 life cycles. Okay, robot rant. So we had this horrible project to make a weather box, which means we had to move 3 different types of motors, and it was just so brutal because these motors, the one that gave us the most problems are the Lego motors, and they're just like made to be used with the like easy to use Lego brick, and we had to like plug it into a circuit board we made that was way different, and so it gave us so many problems. And I was in NOLOP, which is the cool new makerspace, until like a wee hour in the morning, and it was pretty brutal. And then the actual presentation of the project is like peer graded, and my partner like kind of botched the delivery of it. So even though it worked, I think we're gonna get a bad grade. And it's just like, oh man, maybe I won't have a guest on next week and I will just talk about this class. Okay, I have very little time left. And so I would just like to say, this is Molly. You're listening to Chatting with Molly on 91.5 FM, WMFO Medford, Tufts Free Form Radio. Thanks for tuning in. We will see you next week. And up next is a little You Make My Dreams Come True.